Rodell here once more. IVS Oral History Project. Today is August 28, and we've just had lunch, an early lunch, because it's 10 after 12. I'm in the home of Willie Myers, who was in Vietnam first as a volunteer and then later in a staff position as a team leader. The volunteer time was 63 through 65, with a short break home and then back to Vietnam 1966-67. We'll get into the more specifics on the time periods and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that's enough for introduction, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the first question that I outlined before, what I didn't say is that I treat interviews more as a casual conversation rather than a staccato kind of, you know, question answer, quick, so that you could take your time and deliver it more as you would, as we've been talking, rather than as interrogation. I think some people try to press it in interrogation. I don't like to do that. Don't think it's necessary. But anyway, first question is, as I said before, something about yourself, where and when you were born, who your parents were and what they did for a living, their influence on you, and also any other influences that helped to make the young Willie Meyer who would eventually come to IVS. And now I finish off my coffee while you work, unless I chirp in just, you know, to cover a few things.
I was born in November 24, 1941, and it was in Souderton, Pennsylvania, which is about midway between Philadelphia and Allentown. Used to be a
northwesterly
small town with farms around it. Now it's a bedroom community for Philadelphia. And relatively few farms remaining.
The
family that I grew up in, I was the youngest of seven children, so it was a big family. My father was a Mennonite minister, and in those days, Mennonites didn't salary their pastors, so he had a profession to earn a living, and that was, during most of my life, it was carpentry, and he did remodeling jobs, and he never built houses or office buildings, but he had a small crew that did remodeling work, things like that, and that was the main, his main sort of income. We also had, we usually had some animals and some, we had about 2 acres of land, so we did a little crop and animal raising for
family,
our own purposes.
Family food,
We did have a commercial chicken operation for a while. I mean, I remember getting little chicks and raising them and selling them, so it wasn't all just for the family, but that didn't last very long.
Is that kind of like a 4-H project kind of thing?
No, it was just, you know, another attempt to earn some income, you know, from it, from our property.
All right.
The schooling, about the time that I got to school age, the church, the Mennonite church, had started Mennonite Elementary School. So I was educated from start to finish in Mennonite schools. By the time I got to high school, they had the high school. And
they built it just for you.
ready for me, and then I went to Goshen College after that. So I was...
confirms the whole thing.
very well protected from worldly influences. As you may know, the Mennonite church is very strong on service, so that was drilled into me from the beginning.
Even your father's example.
Yes.
I mean, he's a minister who's not getting a real salary.
Right.
And does this out of dedication. Yeah.
Another feature of the church teaching is the military service being against the practice of church, and it was so most of us were almost automatically, you know, got classified as conscientious objectors, which was 1AO.
I've heard it enough.
That was part of the consideration of going to IVS. I think at that time it wasn't the thinking of time, was not very important when you're graduating from college, at least not in my day.
Mm-hmm.
When it came to applying for, I knew I wanted to go into some kind of service after college, and it was either MCC or Peace Corps or IVS. I don't remember if I actually formally applied to anything with MCC, but I did to the Peace Corps and IVS, and the Peace Corps had a posting in Sierra Leone, as I recall, and IVS was in Vietnam. And as I remember it, the main reason that I chose IVS was because I was interested in Asia.
Hmm.
And that was because I had a Japanese roommate when I was a junior in college. So, at that time, it was the spring of 63, at least for me, going to Vietnam wasn't anything more or less special than going to Sierra Leone or some other place. I mean, Vietnam wasn't that big in the news at the time. And so that wasn't really a factor. I mean, whether it was a newsy place or not, I don't think of it as a factor in deciding to go there. And like I say, the alternative service thing was a factor, although I wouldn't have thought much about doing 2 years in the Peace Corps and then doing alternative service some other time. You know, the time was not, we weren't, at least I don't recall being worried about, I got to
whether it was 2 years or four.
So I think it was sort of the Asian interest sparked by my Japanese roommate who was from Tokyo Christian University. He was at Goshen for his junior year. And that's kind of how I get there. I was...
You had already known about IBS then?
Yeah, because, MCC was involved, or at least William Snyder and some kind of particular from MCC was involved in organizing IVS. And there were already John Whitmer, who was graduated from Goshen a year before I did, was in IVS already. So there, that was a link. And I don't remember whether somebody came around to Goshen recruiting or not, but there were Gene Stolzfus and I, he was first year seminary when I was a senior in college, and we went at the same time. So there were at least two of us from that year who, from Goshen, that joined IVS. And then there were more later. there. So it was well enough known in the
we can get this guy.
It was well enough known in the
I see a splatter. We just don't have the cadaver.
We tried to get it. Fly.
I'll pause this.
Oh yeah,
thing.
Here he is. Okay. I'll whack him a few more times. Wash him into the carpet.
Leave it for Dolly. Oh, the great white hunters have bagged another one.
So it was IBS was well enough known at that time. As an alternative service, option.
Yeah.
And
it's really Asia more than anything else. In terms of the actual final selection, this one or that.
And another thing that just came to my mind about that time, there was a person at Eastern Mennonite College. And I don't know why I was there or how I got to talk to him. But he had been over in Vietnam at MCC.
Oh, okay.
And I somehow talked to him before before I went.
Mm-hmm. Before you had to decide or before you actually went?
I think I had already decided to go.
Okay.
I can't think of his name right now. But anyway, one thing he said that I've always remembered and turned out to I saw for myself later is he said, as long as I don't read the newspapers and news magazines, I think I have a pretty good idea what's going on over there.
And you didn't understand that
Boy, later, when I started reading Time magazine and what they were saying, it didn't really compute, so I experienced it myself.
Students are amazed when I tell them I really very rarely read a newspaper or magazine.
Well, I do. I guess I've forgotten some of that lesson, but I'm pretty skeptical.
Yeah. I'll read some of the opinion things in the longer articles, but not the daily stuff.
Like just today, this brought back memories of Vietnam too. They announced that the government has admitted that they knew for a long time that nerve gas was troops in Desert Storm were exposed to nerve gas.
Gee. Wow.
Just didn't want to tell anybody for a while.
Yeah, I'm shocked. Shocked. Anyway, back a few years ago.
Yeah. So how am I doing background-wise?
I think pretty good. What did your mom do in terms of career housewife?
She was a housewife. I think before she married my father, she was a telephone operator.
Okay.
But she didn't...
Well, with seven children at that time, she was probably pretty much housebound.
Yeah, she was pretty busy with us, and it wasn't really the thing to do in those days either.
Not necessarily, unless she had some sort of previous professional degree as a teacher or a nurse or something like that.
And they married... relatively, I mean, I should know this, but I think they married in the late 20s or something like that. They didn't marry early like a lot of people did in those days.
Well, it depends on when they did marry.
And my dad, the other thing, I guess, influence as far as this, my dad was always kind of a wanderlust kind of person. I mean, in those days, we didn't travel abroad, but he would... take us up to Vermont, and he would do church. We had some relatives up there, but he would do like summer programs, summer Bible school, or some other programs in the summertime in Vermont, and we'd go there. And we traveled quite a bit, I think, to the Midwest and New England and probably Virginia, those areas we got to quite a bit. And so there was never any discouragement of me going, you know, abroad. It's kind of partly because of the service emphasis, but also the I don't remember any of my other siblings had gone abroad by that time. No, I don't think so. But it was well accepted, and so that probably was a contributing factor also.
That's pretty clear that all these things have come together, and that the IBS was an obvious alternative right in front of you.
Yeah, it was.
Unlike others who might have had to go out of their way to find something, it was there to trip over rather than, or to ignore rather than to find. So we can move on, I think, to basically getting into the organization. You mentioned that you went at the same time as Jim Stoltzfus. I always probably mispronounce that, but it's
that's okay.
Don Luce just says I call him Stoltz.
he used to be called Foos.
Foos. Oh, really?
Not in my IBS, but I think at Goshen.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Check that out.
Okay. Yeah, all right. I will. I'll report back to you. What was training like, both in country and then on your way to area of service?
As I recall, we were delivered to Washington, D.C. for probably a week or so orientation program. We were went around to the Vietnamese Embassy and State Department, AID, of course, IBS, you know, had their own orientation things for us. The because coming out of the Mennonite fold, you know, the people that I connected with there were a couple of Mennonites. One was William Snyder, who was a member of the IBS board of directors and one of the founders, and so he was interested in us as kind of his part of his fold. And then there was Dick Peters, who had been an IBSer before, and at this time may have been working in the Washington office. I sort of think he was, although I'm not absolutely sure. so he was part of the orientation. If I'm not mistaken, the charge d'affaires at the Vietnamese embassy was Ngo Vinh Diem. Ngo Vinh Diem. No, that's not right. Anyway, it was a man who we later, I mean, he was the guy that sort of gave us our, it wasn't the ambassador, there wasn't an ambassador at that time. But he was the one who gave us the briefing, you know, on behalf of people in charge of affairs. And I, if I'm not mistaken, he's the one who later on worked with us in the post-IBS, you know, Vietnam, Tran Van Dinh. Tran Van Dinh, I think. When we were back in Washington teaching about the horrors of the war, he was came in. Yes, as a matter of fact, he was charged with affairs in the U.S. 1963. So
My memory isn't too bad.
No, your memory is great.
So that was sort of an interesting circle because we went back to Washington in 67.
His attitudes were changing as much as yours.
Right. And he was one of our, we were running the Speakers Bureau, he was one of the speakers that we
Have
provided.
You had contact with him?
No, I haven't. Maybe Don has. I'm not sure. I have any idea where he is. Actually, I think through John Summer, General T also, or is it General T from what he was from Lane, also was one of our speakers.
Oh, really?
The former Air Force general in the Vietnamese Army. Or Air Force.
Yeah.
So that was, let's see, the orientation. Then we went, flew out of...
Probably Dulles. Or no, not Dulles.
We may have flown out of... Yeah, I would...
Or National.
Anyway, we went... they were... I guess they were pretty generous because, as I recall, we stopped in Tokyo and I got to visit my Japanese roommate for a couple of nights. I think we stayed there. I stayed with his family. And I think Gene did, too. Gene Stolfi. And then we stopped in Hong Kong at least one night, and a friend of mine from church, who was a year older than me, was there in MCC, and he showed us around. And so we had a little bit, I mean, they weren't rushing us out there, I guess. They gave us a little, you know, it was at least one night in each of those places. And then the day that we arrived in Saigon, they took us to Metal, which is a little bit south, where our language training and the rest of the orientation was. And so they basically saw to it that we didn't spend any time in Saigon at all until later. And we had a month there in language training and sort of general acculturation or acclimation to the environment. It was a town that a lot of nights you could hear small arms fire going on around, so you got to get used to the
even
the
in 63
sound. It was not in the city, but you could hear it.
When in 63 was this that you actually camped?
June.
So GM was still alive.
Yep. And by the time he was assassinated, actually I'm not sure where I was because I originally came as a member of the English teaching team.
Right. Because you said that Carl Stockton was one of the members of that, that group. And that
and,
was the first group, by the way.
Yes, it was the first teaching group, and somewhere in there, the IVS was asked to participate in the Hamlet Education Program, which AID was sponsoring to help villages build better schools for their elementary kids. Kind of self-help, they didn't provide the materials and ask the community to build it. So they somehow or other got some of us to do that, to switch over. James Dulcers was one, I was one. People that had either an interest or some, you know, I worked as a carpenter with my dad and my brother also. In summers, I knew something about building, and being a person as a farm boy, and they know everything.
They know everything,
And Pete Hunting. I don't remember who the I think maybe John Summer was in that group too. Anyway, there was a few of us that were pulled out of the teaching into this sort of other, I would call it education and community development, because it was sort of rural self-help.
Rather than the other folks who were directed towards larger towns and cities.
Yeah, and they were, you know, they had actual teaching assignments in the school. My teaching English was kind of a part-time, you know, service to the local high school.
Okay.
And anyhow, I went to Vinlong originally, and things didn't work out there for one reason or another. I think the, I'm not sure I know all the reasons, but I think the education, what is it called? Anyway, the elementary school officials probably were not very eager about this program, and and being a greenhorn, I wasn't, you know, able to sort of get things going. So I think about a month later, through probably through aid channels, they found out that the chief of the elementary school office in another province, Kinfong, was
gung-ho.
And I do remember Gladys Philpott was the woman in AID who was honchoing this program.
I'm glad you didn't say IBS, because that name meant absolutely nothing to me.
But she would come around and check on us, and she was the person that we related to in AID, and that she was in Saigon. I mean, she wasn't. In fact, where I went in Kien Phong, which was a small province, there was no aid person at all at that time. The June or July or July or August maybe of 63. So they made me live with military guys, the MACV, or the military advisors. There was this compound with
just what a Mennonite boy would want to do.
Compound with a barbed wire and a bullet and all this stuff.
Oh, no.
And about, I don't know, I guess about a dozen army guys. You know, a major was the head of it, and then, you know, they were advisors to the province officials and the army there and so on. And
all
and
officers then?
No.
Oh, really?
They were, there was, well, they have to have NCOs, I mean,
a few clerk typists and things.
The staff and so on. But I lived in that barracks for a while. It was kind of an awkward situation, because they wanted to be sure that I would know how to handle a gun, a rifle. I shouldn't say gun. You can't call in the army. It has to be a rifle or something. And I told them that I was a conscientious objector, and I wouldn't be able to participate in this activity. He said, well, you just wait and see. You will when the time comes, or something to that effect. But that was an interesting situation. The thing that, and it was because the province didn't want to have responsibility for me. I mean, I was the only non-military American there. And the aid guy who was covering that region didn't live there. He'd just come through once in a while. And I think he covered two or three provinces. Well, then,
You couldn't live with a Vietnamese family?
No. I mean, the next step was that the aid guy, fellow who then became the aid rep, still covering two provinces, as I was also to some extent. It was Kim Dung and Kim Phong, but I was living in Kim Phong. when the aid guy came, he said, I am not going to live with the military. He said, I demand that I be able to live in another place. So I was able to live with him. He was, by the way, a former lieutenant in the Army.
First had lieutenant. Enough.
So his armory was at least as complete as the military guy. You know, he had a machine gun, a bunch of guns, a rifle, excuse me. and he also wanted to teach me how to defend our house in case we were attacked. And he also didn't, he believed that I would forget about all this nonviolent stuff, you know, whenever we were in the situation. So we didn't argue about it a lot. He just said, yeah, we'll wait and see. You know. So I lived with him maybe after a month or two with the military advisors. that was also a little closer to town. It was right on the edge of town where it's the military. I was closer. The only thing that we're still kind of isolated in the sense, you know, about talking about living with a Vietnamese family and so on, because there was a guard detail outside of our house all the time. I mean, like 4 to 5 well-armed local militia.
This is specifically to protect the AID guy.
Yeah, our house, protect our house,
yeah.
The barbed wire around. So it wasn't like I could entertain my friends or anything like that. I mean, they'd probably be scared to death to come.
We
had, you know, we would eat breakfast together, and you know, I'd go to their places and stuff like that. So I was there before the assassination of Vernon Jim, and then, of course, Kennedy's assassination followed soon thereafter, and I lived there for a year and traveled between that province and the next one between us and the Cambodian border, which was Kien Tung. And there I did have to stay with the military all the time when I was visiting because it was...
You were only visiting.
Yeah.
You could hardly set up something.
Although I think, well, wait a minute. I think I may have been able to stay at the hotel, but I'm not sure. Anyhow, we moved around, I mean, pretty well. The only way to get there, though, was to fly, you know, on one of either the military or the Air America flights that were delivering me on a few kind of stuff around.
It is
couldn't
pretty good.
Drive there at that time.
Well, not only the transportation, but even the living arrangements are pretty good testimony of the lack of security, even by 63.
Yeah, they were certainly scared. I mean, they were, in this case, they weren't used to having Americans living out in the... I think actually later, even though general security declined, it was more accepted. Later on, in that same town, it was the town of Khao Lang in Kien Phong, it was the capital of Kien Phong province. The IVS team that was there when I was team leader, 3 years later, there were 3 or 4 people, and they were living in their own house.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't so much the real security, it was just that it was something...
The perception of it,
they were... probably really worried about the responsibility they had to protect us and so on, so they didn't want us, you know, exposed and all this stuff.
Okay.
So I think later on, actually, it was better when I think Bob Minnick was there in 66, and I can't remember who else, but they had their own, and they rented a place for IBSB fund maybe in the town. So. Later ones were had less of a problem. Then I don't remember how the whether this Hamlet education program or schooling program phased out or what happened to it, you know, at what point in time, because these things are, that was the really big push at that moment, you know.
Right.
And it was part of the Hearts and Minds, you know, thing. And it, actually, the, I remember that the village people would sometimes say, we can build our own school, but we need somebody to send us a teacher. I mean, they could they could build a school.
They didn't necessarily
but they didn't
the
have the money to
the,
buy the teacher, I mean, to pay the teacher.
Yeah.
And so they kind of felt it wasn't quite right, the mix, you know, that they weren't getting what the, was. They could build a thatch school, it wouldn't be bricks and cement and so on.
With a metal roof and all that.
But
it,
they
kids
could build
be
something,
in it.
Yeah. But it was a teacher that they really wanted. And there were people, you know, anywhere in the world when there's construction, you know, there's an opportunity for graft and corruption. So,
as well.
So there's there was some of that, too, which was, I remember Gene Stolsters, you should ask him about him going out and kicking down a wall to show how poorly built it was. I never did anything so
dramatic,
radical as that. But I'm pretty sure that that's a true story. You'll have to ask him.
Okay. I'll make a note to myself, actually.
About a year later, summer of 67, IBS was looking around for a science teacher because Vince McGeehan, I think his name was, Vince McGeehan, had started something new. He was a science teacher from the U.S., and he decided it would be a good idea to have a training program for science teaching in the elementary school teachers. And so he got this thing going in Hue and rounded up some equipment and got some support from the idea. And for the, I think the vehicle and some basic science stuff. And the local department of elementary schools and well, I keep saying elementary schools, I don't remember if that department covered all the schools or just when it was separated, but he was leaving. This was like in his second year when he started it, and I had a math or a science background. I mean, I was a math physics major. And I was, I guess, the closest thing they had to replacing them. So in my second year, went to Hue to take over that program. And spent the second year there doing quite different things. I mean, what we did was, I worked with two Vietnamese teachers, Nguyen Hoa, who's now in Washington, D.C., she's a librarian, I think she has her doctor's degree in library science.
Yes, I interviewed her.
Yeah. And she was the continuity in that program because she worked with Vince, and then I came and I left and she stayed. And in fact, one of the things that she would remind us about from time to time is that we would come and go and they stayed.
She would be around, yeah.
And for all of Vietnam, you know, that was a
a good reminder for volunteers to hear every once in a while.
And so we would put together a package of materials, and these were supposed to be, you know, things that teachers could make from local materials. You know, like you do the arm, the two pieces of wood with a balloon to show how the muscle works and stuff like that. And things with local materials, building things to use in teaching science. So we would organize a, say, a session in the office, and then we would travel around to the schools and give it to groups of teachers like that. So it would be like a week here, and then going around for a week or two, and then come back for a week, and so on. So I was, in a sense, learning at the same time, because I didn't know anything about teaching. And so I had to sort of help keep that going. And they actually obviously did most of the work. I mean, I wasn't the one doing the teaching when we went out.
Right.
I mean, I spoke some Vietnamese, but not that well. That program, then, it continued and expanded. I mean, it went then, I think, to maybe three other provinces. I'm not sure how big it eventually became, but it was something that went on for some time, several years. In fact, there was a fellow who graduated from the same high school I did who came out and did that.
Really?
One of those, he may have gone to Goshen also, but anyhow, he was one, he was 2 years behind me, I think, and then he was later on doing that in another province. So I think Quinh Hoa stayed with that program, not just in Hue, but, you know, for quite some time.
As well as, she described herself also as working with volunteers for language instruction and the like. She's retired now. She had a heart attack and is bouncing back.
Oh, great. Well, yeah. I had heard that she was ill. I think John Summer usually tells me about her, but I'm not sure if he was the one. But
well, I went to her metro stop, and she met me out there rather than directing me to her apartment, because she wanted to walk there and then walk me back so that she could get in her morning walk. She looked fine. I could give you the address.
Yeah, well, I get to Washington. But where does she live? I mean, what, is it in the city, or?
No, it is, it's Virginia.
Yeah.
It's beyond National Airport. I think the Orange Line. If that goes out there. Anyway.
Yeah, a lot of times I go to Washington, I kind of run in and run out, so I don't get to see anybody, but.
Right. Well, when I'm there for conferences, I barely pick up the phone, even. Pause this while we take care of this. Okay, I have this on again, and I'll have to remember to send the new address on, which I didn't have here. So you were talking about the mobile science unit, and so that was the second year, as you said here, because it was like 663 through 664
right,
in the Hamlet program, and then the other year.
It was about half and half, you know.
A month or two either way hardly matters.
Then I went to Washington to be a recruitment officer. Actually, they never had a recruitment officer, or they didn't have one before. The personnel officer, which was John Hughes, would do the recruiting also. And I think we were starting to get bigger.
Yeah.
And they wanted to have Uh-huh. So, I moved into Washington and would organize trips, you know, to parts of the country, visiting campuses. Usually I'd be about a week at home and 2 weeks out or something like that, you know, between, country. It didn't seem to me, I remember going, being in Northeast, Midwest, West. I don't remember going to the South for some reason. Mm-hmm. I never, maybe somebody else was doing that. John may, anyhow, he would still do some of that. But
maybe the pickings weren't as good there. It didn't justify
the census. Well, I mean, we were going where we already had past volunteers, you know, going back to places where some of them were new, but it was sort of revisiting territory where we had gotten volunteers before.
So that was the overall strategy, because I wondered how the recruiting was strategized. How it was sort of marketed, because here's a small organization that doesn't have the personnel power.
Yeah.
A limited budget. Even if you've got the AID contracts and you wheedle some money out of AID for your recruitment, you still are on something of a shoestring.
Yeah, so I wonder John how you probably prioritized. Remember that better than I did as personnel officer. And Richard Dope, who was program officer, so he was never good at it. But I think, you know, kind of word of mouth is still the best sales.
yeah, I agree with that too.
But certainly for an organization like IVS, it was quite a help to build off of, you know, volunteers that came from those places. And I wouldn't, I couldn't remember, I'm sure, what proportion of places I visited were new territory. And I don't even, other than not remembering going to the South or South, I know I was in California, but I don't think I hit the Southwest.
Either.
South. Yeah.
Well, the agriculture schools that I've seen people recruited from were all in a band straight across. So it would have made sense to continue to go there, and then the Peace Church schools.
Yeah.
And then wherever else an occasional person was picked up. Just to economize it. Make sure that you got a chance at recruiting at least one person from each day's stop.
The other thing, I remember going to Northwestern because my daughter's going there now, and it just
clicked
when we went to visit. And when this was also relates to the mechanism. A member of the board of directors was from Evanston. He met me.
Board of directors of IBS.
Of IBS.
Okay, not of the university.
Right.
Okay.
He met me and sort of, you know, took me around. He was a banker from Chicago. I can't remember his name.
So he didn't have any connection with
Northwestern. I don't think that we had any volunteers from there at the time.
Okay.
But we did get, I remember at least one person at that time that I talked to. And I don't think it was in there. I think there were some others.
Because Northwestern is Methodist, isn't it?
Used to be.
used to be.
I don't know whether it was at that time or not. You know, like you say, the state universities, the church schools, mostly. Brother Mennonite crime areas.
Sure. Especially as the war intensified then. The need not just to get the proper draft status, but to find suitable and attractive
alternative service. In that sense, I'm sure recruitment became easier, because then maybe not always for the best reasons. I mean, some people were drawn to Vietnam for a variety of reasons, to get there and see what was happening.
Yeah, I've talked to people who went later and said that they wanted to see them. They wanted to go. I mean, even if they were conscientious objector, it wasn't against Vietnam. It was simply against military participation.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, they wanted to offset it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think the visibility of the things that were going on it would have scared off some people, but it also attracted some people. Who wanted to go and for whatever reason, there's a great need, or because curiosity, whatever.
Uh-huh.
But, I don't remember what happened to recruitment. How it was organized, after I left. I know the person that came after me was Harold Cooper, who had followed me into the mobile science program when I was from the same high school that I was.
That's the fellow.
I think he was in the recruitment thing for now.
Mm-hmm.
So they must have had he's deceased already.
I see. Okay.
He died at least 10 years ago from at a relatively young age from a rare disease that he picked up in Singapore or something.
Oh, dear.
He was working for the Chase or the Citibank.
Okay.
It was Citibank or Chase Manhattan Bank in Singapore.
Yeah, I've already got a mark. What impresses me also, did I cut off something?
No.
Is, of course, later you were one of the four to resign, but here you are not that much away from that time, actively recruiting for IDS to send people to Vietnam. So what were your thoughts about both the organization and the war at that time and what could be done?
Yeah, well, at that time, and I think well into my second tour, I was still thinking along the lines that a positive effort was necessary, I mean, even more so because of the increasing military engagement and so on that was going on from the U.S. side. And the turn in sort of perception, I think, would have come within the last few months that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I think the I went back in the summer of 66 to be team leader in the Delta, or Region 4, as we called it. and IBS was getting bigger. And in retrospect, I mean, what we probably were conscious of it at the time, but more so later, that AID was increasing our presence to also, in a sense, consciously offsetting the negative elements of the military. I.F. Stone, remember he used to do the newsletter, and he said later that IBS was like a band-aid on a cancer, a band-aid on a cancer.
That was him?
Yeah.
Okay, because other people have said that.
I'm pretty sure that he was the originator of that. He was a very perceptive journalist, and we got to meet him later when we were in Washington, you know, in the Vietnam Education Project. But anyway, when I went back, well, there was Peter Huntington, was killed in, I think it was in November of 65, and I don't remember who filled in as the fourth Region 4 leader. Until I got there, but I got there about June of 66. And Gene and John Summer had stayed on, you know, they moved after their 2 years into, I think Gene was second Region 2 leader, and John Region 1 had been central, if I remember correctly. And so in a sense, we were sort of back together for,
at a different level
for the next period. And
it would have been with Region 3 by then. Is that wrong?
Maybe.
Okay.
Don Ross. So I think, like I say, it wasn't until various things, I think, build up to the resignation and thing, and one of the
Pause for the phone. Turn this back on again.
We were on. So I think the thing that was
it's running.
Beginning to happen is that we would hear more and more often from our Vietnamese friends that even though we may have be doing some good, it was in a sense covering up for, you know, the bad things that were going on, and that there were really two messages that came out of that. One was that it would be better for us to, well, that the maybe by putting a positive side on the American presence, that we were prolonging the acceptance of the Vietnamese people or whatever to this. And the second thing was that we would do them more good if we could do something about the overall war policy rather than, you know, being the bandage on the cancer, as I.F. Stone, I think it was I.F. Stone, said that. And so though I can't think of any sort of specific climatic event that changed this, but I just think it was sort of...
So no epiphany that suddenly
and floored you. I can't even... remember much about the sequence of things that happened. I think Gene and Don Luce probably would remember better because they were in Saigon. Gene was a Saigon staffer by then, associate director for CD or something. And, I was, you know, in Tanta. So I think things began to happen there in Saigon before I really got directly involved, but the I think I see it as a kind of gradual process that kind of accelerated, you know, near in the summer of 67, and led up to the letter and the resignations. And, you know.
That process, though.
Yeah.
That process was accompanied by many meetings of large numbers of volunteers, or was it more informal discussions between the four of you and maybe a few others, like maybe Summer and, you know, et cetera?
Well, that's what I can't remember very much about that.
Okay.
And it, maybe because I was out
away.
Of town, I was not there in the headquarters, and that maybe not as aware of all the, you know, things that were going on. But the there were meetings, and I would guess that it was mostly, you know, in the 3 months preceding our actual resignation. What I do remember is that Arthur Gardner came out to try to talk us out of it.
So IVS Washington had
Yeah.
plenty of rumors. And
well, we I.